maybe 30 or 20 years ago, a Saudi might have said, I'm Muslim and I'm Arab and I'm Saudi. Now they might say, I'm Saudi and I'm Arab and I'm Muslim.
You know, they're trying to radically refashion their country and they need help from the best experts in the world. Do you want to have your country's people be disqualified from that because of some essentially antiquated point of view about how countries work together?
In recent months, it can feel like Saudi Arabia is intent on buying the world. It's bought up much of golf, sports teams, many of the globe's best soccer players to its own domestic league, and it owns huge chunks of many of the biggest companies on the planet. But Saudi Arabia is not just on a shopping spree. The once insular, oil-rich kingdom is transforming into a major diplomatic and military player, a pivotal actor in the energy transition, and looks set to host high-end cultural events like the FIFA World Cup.
You know, they know that buying a football club immediately brings you a billboard into a global game that allows you to completely reposition yourself and rebrand yourself.
It feels like we're entering the era of the Saudi project. But what exactly is the kingdom trying to achieve, and will it succeed? Coming soon from Intelligence Squared, The Saudi Project is a new podcast series seeking to answer some of these questions and more.
Britain does have choices. It's not either-or situation. We either indulge Mohammed bin Salman or boycott Mohammed bin Salman. There is a third choice.
Search The Saudi Project wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Welcome to Intelligence Squared. I'm Connor Boyle. Coming up on the podcast, we hear from the writers and publishers of a new book celebrating fiction written by women authors in Afghanistan. Our host is the investigative journalist and journalism professor, Halima Kazem. Her work has been largely focused on Afghanistan, feminism, and human rights. She's produced stories for outlets ranging from CNN to NPR. Here's Halima with more.
Afghan women's voices are at risk of being silenced. And as more of their rights slip away, so do their stories. My pen is the wing of a bird. It will tell you those thoughts we are not allowed to think, those dreams we are not allowed to dream. These are the words of Batul Haidari, an Afghan woman and author from Untold, a writer development program for marginalized writers in areas of conflict and post-conflict. In March 2022, Untold published the first anthology of short fiction by Afghan women, titled after Haidari's quote, "My pen is the wing of a bird." It brings together 18 unique voices, translated from Pashto and Dari, telling stories of family, work, childhood, war, gender identity, and cultural traditions. Today, I'm joined by three women who've been deeply involved in the creation of this book. Lucy Hanna, founder of Untold. Zarguna Kargar, author of Dear Zari, Hidden Stories from Women of Afghanistan. Journalist and translator. And Marie Bamyani, contributing author, featured in My Pen is the Wing of a Bird. Zarguna, Lucy, and Marie join me now to talk about their work. Welcome to Intelligence Squared. If we could start, Lucy, and each of you, tell me a bit more about your work in your background, in your writing, and how you got involved in this project.
My first introduction to Afghanistan was in about 2006, when I was there for the BBC working on the long-running soap opera, New Home, New Life. I have a history of working with new writers and developing them and their work. And this was one aspect of that work. And while there, I then went back several times, back and forth on this project. And in 2017, I was talking to the scriptwriters and we were having a conversation about fiction publishing locally. And the women in particular were talking about how frustrating it was to get their work published, their fiction work published, as opposed to their script writing that was their day job, and that they would either have to pay to get it published, and there was no infrastructure in terms of editing, and there certainly were very few literary translators that would get that work beyond their borders. And so that sparked the idea, and three of us, myself, Sharifa Pasoon, who's in the anthology, and Parand, who is a, which is a pen name for another of the writers in the anthology, decided to try to start a project that might help to develop local women's voices in terms of their creative writing, support the local infrastructure and build the capacity of local literary translators and editors, and to encourage wider readership of their work in translation. That's how the idea started.
Thank you. How about Zarhuna?
Thank you for having me. I am originally from Kabul. I was born there. And I became a refugee when I was young to Peshawar. And then over 20 years ago, I came to the UK with my family. And I have, since then, I've worked for the BBC in different parts. And currently, I work for BBC World News TV as a journalist. And I also write from time to time, specifically about women, and because I have an interest and love for the women of my country. And when Lucy contacted me about this project she was starting, I was very excited and I said, yeah, I would do whatever help you need. So I got involved in Untold with Lucy's suggestion, and I started reading most of the stories that the writers had sent in both Dari and Pashto. And I've also translated some of the stories that are published in the anthology from both Dari and Pashto. To see the book published and the stories of women published is just wonderful, especially at this time, you know, Halima Jan. As you said in your intro, Afghan women are not going through very bright time at the moment. So it's a very important step, and I think it's a very important book in terms of raising their voice and letting the world know about their stories and about what kind of life they lead.
Yes, the current situation makes this work that much more important, that it captures a time where maybe perhaps Afghan women had more openings and possibilities for their writing. And today, that has changed. That changed after August 15th of 2021. Mari, how did you hear about the book? And can you tell us about how you reached out to Lucy and Zarhuna to get your work into the book?
Actually, I heard about Untold from my brother. I never expected that my story going to be published, because based on my experience in Afghanistan, published industry is kind of dominated by men mostly. So when I heard that my story going to publish, it was the happiest moment I ever thought about that.
Mari, thank you. Zarhuna, would you like to add something?
I just wanted to add to this point that Mari said about how there is no enough belief in the capability of women in our society. I remember when I was training young women journalists in Kabul, a lot of my male colleagues would comment on the way they wrote. We wanted to make it very simple because it was a program that was broadcast for housewives, for family. So we wanted to make it very simple, but they would criticize it. And also Lucy will remember this. When we were reading the stories, there were some colleagues and friends, Afghan friends, that were with us reading the stories. And whenever they read, and some of them, when they liked the story by Afghan female authors, they would say like, oh, she's really talented, it's very good, and I'm surprised, I'm shocked, these words. So I had a little bit of friction with them, like, oh, why are you talking like this? As if you don't know what Afghan women are about. I said, like, I'm not shocked at all. I'm like, I knew this would come. So, like, it's just that belief that I'm sure you understand, Halima Jan, that is in our society, because men have always had the upper hand. So when it comes from women, and unfortunately in publishing, it has affected Afghan women in terms of being published in magazines, in books, in things like that. It's always been men who had the upper hand. And this has been a wonderful opportunity for the women of Afghanistan, I think. This will also hopefully help the mentality that is in the country, especially the men's mentality, look, these are good. You can't ignore them.
I completely agree with both of you that in Afghan culture, writing is revered and respected. And when you are published, you have arrived. And men are given that opportunity. But I wonder if these cultural norms affect their acceptance. And I think it does, of allowing women that space to arrive, to be present, to be recognized. Can these cultural norms be barriers for women writers, especially now when the Taliban are back?
Writing in Afghanistan for a woman or for a girl is not easy. You have to fight with your family, you have to fight with your society, you have to fight with a lot of norm and regulation and culture. And then at the end, after fighting with this much people, if you can publish, they won't take it serious. So this is the situation, I think, in Afghanistan. If you are a girl, you have to work harder compared to a man. I'm not against working hard, but I'm talking about being fair. I'm seeing writers in Afghanistan, especially women. They are not just a writer. They are like a fighter. They fight, then they write.
Thank you, Mari. Zarghuna, you said earlier that you worked on some of the translations. Talk about the challenges of translating such complex text into English for the English-speaking audience.
When Lucy started this project, one point she usually focused on was like, it's literally translation. I agree that she kept pushing for that, and it was a good point because I have done a lot of news translation and document translation and other type of like a verbal translation, but it was my first time doing literary translation, and it was quite challenging. I wanted to make sure that what, for example, Mari writes, I give the same meaning in English, the same tone, the same feeling that are in her writing. So that was more challenging for me. But by reading it again and matching it again and again, it wasn't like you do one translation and it's one draft. For me, it was like reading the whole story once, then starting translating, then working on the English. Because for me, it was mostly about I wanted to be very, very fair to the original author. I wanted to get the voice that is in Dari or Pashto version into the English. I remember, for example, when before this anthology, some of the author's stories were published in Writer Without the Borders magazine. And the editors were doing their own editing for an online magazine. And when they sent it back to me, there were things that didn't make big difference, but I felt that I'm losing the tone. And they agreed with us, whatever we said, they agreed and they appreciated. But it was about that, about keeping the tone, keeping the voice of the author, keeping the feelings that she wants to express.
Lucy, you started this project, from my understanding, before the fall of the Afghan government on August 15, 2021. Has this anthology's meaning changed for you? Has it become even more since then?
Yeah, we started in 2019. We had four translators. Zari was the lead translator. And as you can see, many writers. And just to pick up on the last point, we actually made sure that on all our calls, because all this was done remotely for more than 2.5 years, we had an editor, a writer, and a translator on each call so that unusually, the model was that the translator was witness to the editing process to help them to remain true to the writer's voice. So yes, we were carrying along on a sort of quite a conventional creative writer development process where editors and writers are exchanging ideas along with a translator. And overnight, we went from a sort of creative program to a very different program where the work that had been published for Words Without Borders, as Zari mentioned, and in a few other places in those 2 years, had to be removed immediately offline for security reasons. And we had it was a strange split. We wanted to honour the publisher's request, which had been an arrangement that we would deliver a full manuscript for an anthology by September 2021, which had been agreed 6 months or so before, yet we were suddenly thrust into a position where our contributors were understandably more concerned about their safety and what was going to happen than carrying on finishing their peace. But what was remarkable was that the group, far from wanting to stop, wanted even more than ever to carry on and to make sure that these stories reached this publication. This was going to happen anyway. It was important for this to happen anyway, regardless of the events of August. And it's even more important that we continue this work now. Interestingly, which I'm sure we'll come on to, but the stories in it, even though they were written, some of them were written during the last period of the Taliban, they take on an interesting resonance, almost knowingly, given what happened in August. For example, the first story, Companion, where a mother is talking to her children in America who have left her behind. And we're seeing that, as you know very well, all the time at the moment in various different forms.
That was Nudia's story. And that stayed with me, that story, and her waiting to hear. Beautifully written. Mari, yeah, Lucy mentions that you were still in Afghanistan when this book was in process and up until a few months ago. Can you talk about the moment where things changed in Afghanistan for you?
So when I heard that Taliban took Kabul, I was in an area in Kabul called Sharina, and I was thinking that if they caught me on there, for sure they will shoot me with a gun. Because the way I was dressed on that day, it was against the rule of Taliban.
We make a lot of stuff here at Intelligence Squared. So many great chats to enrich the mind, like the one you're listening to now. But like any business, it's really essential to be in good shape and keep things efficient, so you can see the big picture all in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems, and it's super easy to get started because NetSuite exists in the cloud, so no hardware needed, cutting your IT costs too. And you'll also improve efficiency by bringing all your major processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. The cost of living crisis might not be making anything any cheaper, but there's real value in feeling on top of things, which is something I experience firsthand as an event producer every day. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared. Intelligence Squared is a tight-knit team doing big things, and it means we're always looking for tools that can help streamline managing tasks. That's why I want to talk to you for a minute about NetSuite. NetSuite provides cloud-based software to get things moving. Maybe your business has been humming, but you can feel things are falling behind a little bit. Or perhaps your team is getting snowed with manual tasks and closing those books is taking forever. If this sounds like you, you should know these three numbers. 37,000, 25, 1. 37,000, that's the number of businesses which have upgraded to NetSuite by Oracle. 25, NetSuite turns 25 this year. That's 25 years of helping businesses do more with less, allowing them to close their books in days, not weeks, and drive down costs. And one, because your business is one of a kind, so you get a customized solution for all of your KPIs in one efficient system with one source of truth. It means you can manage risk, get reliable forecasts, and improve margins. It's everything you need to grow all in one place. NetSuite is now making an unprecedented offer to make more of that kind of thing possible. Right now, you can download NetSuite's popular KPI checklist designed to give you consistently excellent performance absolutely free at netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared to get your own KPI checklist. netsuite.com/squared. Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theatre, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece, Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents. With the code SQUARED, simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code SQUARED to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV.
Zarghuna, this is not the first book for you. I have read and enjoyed your first book, Dear Zari, Hidden Stories from Women of Afghanistan. Storytelling with women in Afghanistan is not new for you. Why is literature such an important medium of expression?
As you know, Halima Jan, we have a rich history of women storytellers, women reciting poems who don't get registered in their name. Like in Pashto, we have Landais. And in Farsi as well, in Dari, we have the same. So it's a culture that I have grown up with. I remember my aunt telling us stories in long winter nights when I was a kid. And I really believed it. I really loved it, the way she was telling me stories of monsters, sometimes stories of a man in her village. So I really feel that this kind of work by Afghan women is strengthening that culture we have. Unfortunately, the way we are portrayed in media is either Taliban women in burqa and Afghan women dying of childbirth or malnutrition. I just think that it's so important for the international audience or for people outside Afghanistan to know that Afghan women is not only about that. There's so much more to Afghan women in our culture, in their talent, in their potential. And this book and these stories are just a small example of the potential that lies among Afghan women, young and old, whether they are housewives, whether they are students, whether they are mothers, sisters. It's so colorful, and there is so much talent among women that has been missed for many, many years, especially on international level. In Afghanistan also, as Mari said, we have a very, very male-dominated society. Men are much more further than women in many, many aspects of life. I started reading some books by Afghan authors, mostly men, and it was interesting that they were writing about women, but it was not the same. As Mari said, men cannot write my feelings or Mari's feelings or Sharifa's feelings that are in these stories. So for me, this is a very, very important step to write about them, write their stories, write their feelings, and just let the world know what Afghan women are about, what our grandmas have been about, what our daughters are about, what our girls who are now banned from school, some of them, what are they about? And just want to, it's just a very small example of the potential that lies in that country.
And I'm drawn to a line that Liz Doucette, who wrote the foreword to the book, wrote, that literature is resilience, a release. And then from my work, I work on feminist resistance. And I would add to that line that Afghan women's literature is a form of resistance, a resistance to the invisibility of them in the archives, of the perceived, as Zarghuna Jan is saying, invisibility of them in daily life. And I think that these stories really bring that forward. Lucy, what do you think about that? As literature as a form of resistance.
They say that, you know, it takes a writer, an activist, and a lawyer to make change in the world. And I believe that wholeheartedly. And you can never do without the writer. But interestingly, when I talked to someone about putting out an open call in 2019, and the view was, oh, well, you'll probably only get maybe 20 or so submissions. And we got 120. And the second call was put out in 2021, and we got nearly 300. And from women everywhere, and Mariam Mujuba, who wrote Companion and Please Turn This Air Conditioner On, Sir, two stories in the book, had never shared her work with anyone. Her sister sent in her story, unbeknown to her, because she knew that Mariam wouldn't let her. And also the author of Sandals, Maliha Naji, who wrote it handwritten and photographed it on to WhatsApp. Her brother then sent it to a friend of his, and it got to us via WhatsApp handwritten. So the point being that, you know, Zari talks about the untapped talent. Of course, why on earth would you think only 20 submissions would come in? It's an entire country of people, of women who are looking for outlets to express their work creatively that they have only been doing often behind closed doors and are not taken seriously as writers.
Is Untold still working in Afghanistan despite the conditions? Are you going to continue?
We intend to, but obviously in a very different way. In terms of the cultural norms, I think it's, as you know, it's affecting things hugely, obviously. And we're working out at the moment. So 8 of the writers that are in the anthology are still in Afghanistan. 10 of those in this collection have left. But obviously there are others that we were working with that didn't, whose stories didn't make it into the anthology. And they're also still in Afghanistan. What was interesting in terms of during August, this group began, and Marie was part of this, began to write a diary, an online diary, to keep connected to each other when the Taliban entered Kabul, because they wanted to find a way of not losing that sharing of ideas that we'd been doing for so long. And this has kept going since the middle of August, and it's still going today. The good news is that actually there's going to be a children's book made out of the first 6 weeks of it, published by Scholastic, coming out next year. But I'm hoping the group want to carry on so that we do a year since the fall of Kabul. I think that is going to be the incredibly valuable cultural archive. I'm hoping that that will show how valuable these women's voices are. But also, that aside, we are at the moment hoping to carry on and produce another collection. Because in a way, this is just the beginning. These are writers who've never even experienced the editorial process and who are very keen to develop much different stories and experiment with form and do what many writers have the opportunity to do. So we are working in different ways to make that happen.
Is there a danger for some of the women who are still in Afghanistan to continue working with you? What do you all think? You're in touch with them.
Yeah, all the time. I mean, Zari will, with the BBC Afghan Service, will probably know more, but I'm in touch with people every week, yeah, and also taking advice. People who know best are the writers themselves. We respond accordingly. We just have to remain very, very flexible and very fleet of foot.
At the moment, as you all know, Afghan women are going through a very dark period. Women are being erased from public sphere on a daily basis. Women's rights, simple basic rights like going out of your house or traveling without a male companion, is not possible now. They can't travel without a male companion anywhere. Most important, teenage girls are not allowed to go to school. They have put a clear ban on it. We have to think what consequences this brings to the work and to the life of Afghan women, say this generation. For example, for next year, we will not have 12th grade girls graduating, entering university. And this has happened in our history before, during the first control of Taliban in Afghanistan in the 1990s. So it's going to have a huge impact on women's ability, women's participation in the society. And we have to remember that in the last 20 or over 20 years, we worked really, really hard to at least put this idea in men's heads that women should be involved in this project, or women should be involved in the parliament, women should be involved in a discussion on TV or on radio. And this took us almost, I can guarantee this because I've seen the changes that the Afghan women, it took us 20 years to just spread this idea among families, among men in the country that women need to be present. In everything you do, women should be there, whether there's ministries, working in offices, working in universities, and that is the most important thing that we are losing at the moment. I'm really angry with the feminists in the West that they are not raising their voice about this. The consequences that we dealt with 20 years ago were huge. Women were always behind comparing to men. Sisters were behind comparing to their brothers. And now we are facing that again. And if this is not stopped, I'm afraid the consequences for the women of our country is going to be very, very negative and very, very dark. We need to work hard together, whether it's publishing their stories, whether it's enabling them to send a piece that can get published in a small magazine. That is a huge help, and Afghan women need help at the moment.
And I take your point about the loss of a year for girls in school and what the consequences of that is going to be. And I'll tie it to something that I noticed in the stories that I read from your book, is this sense of waiting. There's a lot of waiting that the women do in the stories. They wait. They wait to be told if their child is a boy or a girl. They wait to hear from their families. They wait for moments to pass, such as the bombing in the newsroom. There's a lot of waiting, and that made me think that Afghan women's sense of time or ownership of time is not their own. And it speaks to their status. And now we are waiting. Every day we are all waiting, like you said, more than 200 days for girls grade 7 to 12 to go back to school. I just couldn't help to just think about that, what that means.
All I can say is I'm heartbroken by the situation of our women every day. And I'm so, so sad. And I'm so, so sorry for all those girls who are sitting at home. And I'm so sorry for the cries they did when their school got shut again. They opened for 30 minutes and they banned them again. So at the moment, I'm always trying to be hopeful and not lose hope. But it's so hard to keep hope. And as you said, wait. Waiting has a limit, you know, and we have waited for very long now.
When I'm talking with my friends, female friends, they are saying that men are the one who is going to save the country. Everyone, every society told me that you have to wait for someone to save you. Like you have to wait for a man to save you from a certain location. You have to wait for your father to take your hand, or you have to wait for your brother to support you in school. So we kind of got trained like this. There should be someone to rescue us from that moment. Well, the fact is that if we see our own ability, if we see our own power, if we believe in ourselves, we can save ourselves. We don't need to wait. Like in Afghanistan, the question is like this, that everyone is waiting for me to go and fight against Taliban and save the country. But I believe women can also help the men in this certain time. As a writer, I'm saying that by writing, I can help my country.
The stories in the book, as heartbreaking as they are, and the sense of precarity that you see in women's lives and the sense of waiting, still gave me hope, because it's in the skill of the writing. It's in the skill of the storytelling. It's within the historical practice of what Afghan women do. And so it still left me with a lot of feelings, and what stood out was hope. Well, thank you, Zari, Lucy, and Murray. That was Zarguna Kargar, Lucy Hanna, and Mari Bamyani, who were all involved in the creation of My Pen is the Wing of a Bird, which is now available from Kirkus. You've been listening to Intelligence Squared. I'm Halima Kazem. Thanks for listening.
The first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.